Hey everyone, this is Steve Mathis. Thanks for listening to the podcast show. Before we begin the show, I just wanted to give a little shout out to my new friends at BTOSports.com. BTOSports.com has teamed up with yours truly to provide you podcast listeners with a cool free deal. What you want to do is go to BTOSports.com and check out all the sweet stuff from Fly Racing, Fuel Graphics, O'Neill, Stella, FMF, Leot, and Vortex. They carry these lines along with pretty much anything else that you need for your bike or body. So you go there. The cool thing is, you order more than $100, and really, what's $100 these days? James Stewart has that much in his Lambo ashtray. Anyways, order more than $100, type in the offer code MATHES, M-A-T-T-H-E-S, in the coupon section, right when you're checking out, and you'll get a special deal. It's so special, they haven't even really told me yet what it is. So to recap, go to btosports.com, spend $100, type in MATHES in the coupon section upon checkout, and get some kind of hella super sweet deal. Remember to check out their closeouts at btosports.com as a proud sponsor of the BBMX race team. All right, on to this week's show.
I repeat, this is a warning. Your brain may explode from listening to this show. We will not be held responsible if it does. What are you going to do about it anyway? You won't have a head. You have been warned.
Welcome to the BTOSports.com podcast show, brought to you by Transworld Motocross, hosted by Steve Mathis.
Welcome to the BTOSports.com Transworld Motocross Podcast Show. I'm your host, Steve Mathis, and it is truly an honor to have this guest on the line with me. It's somebody I grew up reading, somebody that has disappeared from the scene in recent years, but I tracked him down with some help, and now he's on the show. So do I call you Super Hunky? Do I call you Rick Simon? What works?
Call me anything but late for supper. In fact, the reason I was gone 15 years, there was a court battle we had with the Sahara Club and the land use thing. And after the seventh court battle, we won six, and we lost this last one. And I said, the hell with it. I'm going to Mexico. And I moved lock, stock, and barrel to Rosarito in Baja. Yeah, and I was there 15 years.
Wow.
And 14 and a half, those years were fantastic. They were really good years. You couldn't ask for anything better. I could open my garage door up, and between the ocean and my house was 1 mile.
Nice.
And I had motocross tracks laid out there, a Grand Prix track. I could go all the way from my house to Tecate off-road. Uh-huh. It was really great.
And for those who don't know, actually a proper introduction, Rick was is better known as Super Hunky in the magazines, was the editor of Dirt Bike Magazine, definitely in its glory years, a major publication that took our sport, brought a sport to the masses, I guess. Or how long were you the editor at Dirt Bike for?
Well, I started out selling ads for Big Bike magazine before Dirt Bike existed. And I was just a regular old ad stroke. And then we went more and more and more. I kept seeing more and more action happening in the dirt bike thing. Mm-hmm. And I was a dirt biker myself. I'd go out and race on weekends and whatever on old crusty greaves and crap like that. And then I went to the publisher and I said, hey, let's start a dirt bike magazine. He says, what's a dirt bike? Oh, jeez. Yeah. So I finally badgered the guy and talked to him enough to try one shot of a dirt bike magazine. And the thing took off. 33,000 circulation, the first issue of Dirt Bike ever. And
what year would this have been?
1971, the June issue of 1971. And we took that the second time around, we took it to 275,000 circulation.
Wow.
ABC audit. There were three magazines, were the three fastest growing magazines in the United States in 1974. Number one was Penthouse.
Yeah.
Number two was National Lampoon. And number three was Dirt Bike.
Wow.
And unfortunately, Bill Golden, publisher, went back east all the time, which is where he was from. He's from New York. He went back east to a publisher convention, and he kept running into these guys who were old hacks. They did Treating Modern Bride, crap like that. Mm-hmm. And they kept saying, gee, you got some real good numbers here, Bill. If you just did the magazine right, we could have some really great numbers. And he said, oh, yeah? So he'd bring these guys back as a vice president, put them up in a house, give them a credit card and a car and the whole thing. And these guys did not know a motorcycle from a toaster. And they would badger me and drive me crazy and drive me absolutely nuts. So in late 74, I left for the first time. I went and took over Modern Cycle.
Uh-huh.
And we took Modern Cycle, which was a failing publication. It was just going completely downhill. And we took that one, did real good at that. And I took over Dirt Rider, which was there, Minicycle BMX.
Uh-huh.
And I found myself as an editorial director of all three of those publications. I took those and ran them for 4 years. Meanwhile, Dirt Bike Magazine went from 275 down to 101.
Doing it the right way, though, according to the Modern Bride guys.
Yeah. Well, the Modern Bride guys, they would last. Well, I'll give you one example. I got called in the office in 1974 by a guy named Jack D. Fox. He was a bank advertising guy. Uh-huh. He advertised for banks in New York. He says, Simon, he said, we have a real problem here. I said, okay, Jack, what's the problem? He said, well, we had a meeting with the people from Honda, and you agreed not to say Jap bikes. I said, yeah, I agreed, because we did have a meeting there, and the VPs from Honda came up, and they said, please, you guys are saying in your magazine, Jap bikes, and so forth, so please don't say that. It offends us. So Bill looked at me, and I looked at him. I said, okay, I won't say it anymore. So he says, so you have broken our little wish. I said, what are you talking about? He says, right here in this story, you have the Honda XL175 has Nitto tires. Ha, if that isn't a racial slur, I never heard one. I says, Nitto tires? I said, Jack, Nitto tires is a brand. He said, oh, yeah. You can fool some people. You can't fool me.
Yeah.
I know what Nitto means. I said, Jack, I'm telling you, Nitto tire is a tire. He says, no. He says, you get this typewriter right here in front of you. Take my certificate, and you change this copy right now before it goes to the yard department.
Uh-huh.
And I said, okay, sit down. So I sat down in front of his IBM Selectric, got it in both hands, and threw it through his window. And it landed on a Ventura Boulevard from the second floor. And about a half a day later, I gave my my resignation letter.
Nice.
That's the kind of stuff we had. And in 79, I got a phone call from Dick Miller, and he wanted to go to lunch. Mm-hmm. And Dick Miller was at Motocross Action at
right.
the time, back at High Torque. And so he came to me, and he said, Rick, he says, we want you to come back to Dirt Bike. He said, we know you're not happy over here doing... at that time, I was doing all the car magazines, Street Machine, Street Rider, stuff like that. And I wasn't real happy. I was making good money. But Dick said, look, Dirt Bike's just really going bad. He says, Bill Golden wants to see you. I said, well, you can tell Bill Golden he can see me, but it's going to cost him $200 for consulting fee. He said, oh, Jesus, you just don't push it. I said, no, that's I got to have $200 or I won't even talk to the guy.
Yeah.
So he says, okay, I'll see what I can do. He just sighed. He went back. He came back a little bit later with an envelope. He said, okay, here. I looked inside the envelope. There's two $100 bills.
Yeah.
I said, okay, he's got 10 minutes of my time. So the next day, I met Bill Golden at 10 o'clock in his office. I walked in, and he called me names, and I called him names, and you son of a bitch. We called each other. It sounded like a bunch of old bosun mates meeting again. And then he gave me a big hug, and I gave him a big hug. He said, look, he says, we got problems. I said, what kind of problems do you have other than your magazine's dying?
Yeah.
He said, well, I started all these magazines, RV World, Women's Feminine Fitness, and Soccer Corner, and all this other stuff, and Runner's World. And they're all dying, every one of them. There's a thing called advanced publishing. You know what advanced is?
No.
Well, when you get an advance, when you have a track record that's pretty good, and Dirt Bike and Motocross Action had a good track record of making money. So if you make another magazine like Fun Dog Magazine, and you print 100,000 copies and you go through your distributor gives you an advance on estimated sales that are going to be. Because you have a good track record, and the minute he gets the okay from the printer that you have indeed printed 100,000 Fun Dog magazines, they send you a check for, say, 25%.
Right.
They call it an advance.
Yeah.
Well, he got advances for all these magazines. Well, in the magazine business, you don't know what your actual sales are till 6 months after the off-sale date.
Okay.
In other words, you have the January issue.
Yeah.
You don't really know what the January issue did in actuality until June.
Right.
Okay. So here's Bill Golden. He's getting all of these magazines. He's getting advances on, and they're all selling like 6%, 8%.
Uh-huh.
And now the guy is owing a lot of money. And this went on for quite a few years, and he owed several million dollars. I couldn't tell you what the exact number was. But he said, I got real problems. I got to turn this thing around. I want you to come back. I said, well, I don't want to come back. We left on a pretty bad term. He says, you come back, and you can have a total free hand.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Whoa. I said, yeah. So I demand a lot more salary.
Yeah, obviously.
And I said, I want a free hand. I want to hire and fire anybody. And I want to take Paul Clipper with me because Clipper was working with me over at Challenge Publications where we were doing the car books. And we had a good time. So me
that
and
was
Clipper
in,
went.
That would have been in 78, 76?
79.
79, okay.
79.
Yeah, yeah. So from 79 till...
So 79, I said, Bill, how long do I have to turn the magazines around? He says, you got maybe 6 months or they're going to close the door. I said, oh, whoopee. I just left a real sweet little niche over at Challenge Publications.
Yeah. Thanks a lot.
To take this death trap here. So we did the first issue in 79 with Galen Mosher on a cover, going up the Matterhorn and jumping a Nissan and stuff like that. We were giving away a truck.
Yeah.
And we sold a whole lot. I think we sold 140,000 first issue, and it went uphill steadily from there. And it grew. And we had another runaway success again. I fired all the guys who were still in charge of the magazine. They were just running it into the ground.
Yeah.
And, let me give you an example. I won't name names, but the guys who were doing a magazine, one of the guys who did Dirt Bike, went from there to Mother Jones Magazine.
What is that? I already know what that is. What is it?
Mother Jones is an eco-freak magazine.
Oh, okay. Nice.
Yeah,
real nice.
They're the guys that talk about, hiking in your funny earth shoes and whatever.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's the kind of guys that are running it.
Right.
So anyway.
Wow.
So we took Dirt Bike over and we ran really wild. Clipper and I had a great time.
Mm-hmm.
We had Ned Owens, and Ned was a good writer, sort of a wild man, and he was never on time. It was a battle we fought there. We had Dick Krause, Mr. Know-It-All.
Yeah.
We had just a damn good time. It was probably the best job I ever had in my whole life. Unfortunately,
did you hire Wolfman too?
We hired Wolfman.
Yeah.
We had to let Ned Owens go because, as good as a writer as Ned was, the word deadline meant nothing to Ned.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, Clipper and I would be on deadline the night before a magazine was due.
Yeah.
And he'd call me up at 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock in the morning. He'd say, I can't think of a column. Give me an idea for a column. I'd say, shut up and go to sleep. He said, if you don't give me an idea for a column, I'm going to call you every 15 minutes and keep you awake all night long. I say, God, I'm your boss. He said, oh, screw you. He said, give me an idea for a column. I said, okay, do an article on cranberry shortcakes. He said, okay, good. So he'd do a column on how to do a recipe. And it turned out to be damn funny,
funny.
And Clipper and I had. And the real neat thing about our deadline was, the day of deadline, we'd all walk in the office with all our stories. And I'd give my stories to Clipper. He'd give his stories to me. I'd give stories to a web, whatever. Mm-hmm. We'd all go back and forth, and we'd all just roast each other. Any mistakes, anything wrong, we'd just look at each other and cut each other to pieces.
Right.
It was really, really tough, and there was no holds barred, man. It was just fantastic. We had good writing.
Yeah, no.
Excellent. Excellent writing.
It always struck me, you know, growing up, there was only three magazines. There was Dirt Rider, Dirt Bike, and MXA. And Dirt Bike always struck me as sort of the, and don't take this the wrong way, but the less classier publication. Do you know what I mean, though? Like, it spoke to the everyman a little bit more than, say, the other two.
Absolutely right, because I'll tell you what, because I was just an ordinary guy, just to me, my idea of heaven was I had my garage full of test bikes. That's all I needed, right there, test bikes.
Yeah.
I had all these bikes at my disposal. I didn't care about all this funny stuff, a great title, being Mr. Editor, flying to this place, that place, going to Japan, going to here. That didn't mean a whole lot. It's just stuff you had to do. To me, the great thing was getting in my El Camino or my van on Sunday morning and going out to the racetrack, going out to the desert, me and my buddy Tom or my friends, my test riders, and going riding. And we'd go out there, we'd stop at Pickle Bill's, and we'd have breakfast out there, and we'd all we knew the guy had a Bultaco, this guy had a Husky, this guy had Honda, and that's all we knew. We all talked together, we all signed up, we all raced, we had a good old time. On the way home, we'd stop, have a beer and a hamburger, and the stories would flow. And I'd go, whoa. I'd listen to these stories, and that's where I got most of the stories from.
Right, right.
Because all these guys, the straightaways would get faster, the hills would get taller, the bikes would get more powerful. And you listen to all these guys bullshitting with all these great stories, and I just put them down. And that's how the great things happen. And,
you started again in 79, and then how long did that go for? Until about 86, I guess.
Late 85.
Okay.
Late 85.
I remember all of a sudden Super Hunky was gone.
Well, let me tell you one thing that happened before. About 83 or something like that, we did a chain lube shootout.
Uh-huh.
We tested a bunch of chain loops.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that the dirt bike really tackled head on. We weighed bikes, we dynoed bikes, we took things, we would do things that other people wouldn't do. We tested oils,
Jim Hawley tested, jumping a Goldwing.
Oh, yeah, we did wild things. And one of the things we did was we kept seeing all these different chain loops. Everybody said, won't fling or fly off,
right,
your chain will last. We didn't know what the hell one lube worked for another lube. So what we did is we got, about a mile's worth of chain and some starter and solvent to clean the chain in, and a whole bunch of counter shaft sprockets from Suzuki, a bunch of RM125 sprockets. And we took my shopsmith. You know what a shopsmith is?
Yeah.
It's a combination drill press, lathe.
Yeah, kind of a do-it-all machine,
down. Yeah, it's a do-it-all machine. You can put it straight upright into the drill press. You lay it down. It's a lathe. You lay it the other a woodworking tool. It's a sort of a do-all kind of a big thing. It's the size of a piano on its side. So we fixed the thing up to where we had two counter shaft sprockets on there and about a 3-foot length of chain, and we calculated out that the chain would be doing about 70 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm.
Right between these two counter shaft sprockets. And what we do, we clean the chain, perfectly clean, and start it solid. Then we put a chain loop on it according to the directions. And then we let it wait according to the directions. Then we put a white card behind it. And then we'd spin it up.
Yeah.
And we'd see what stuff splattered and flew off. And every one of the chain loops splattered and flew off and left all the stuff. We show pictures of that. And then we ran the thing for about 70 miles an hour for an hour. And then we put a temperature gauge on it, a temple stick, and a temperature gauge. And then we took a microscope and we checked the scar marks on it. We tore a few links apart.
Uh-huh.
We checked the scars on it. We found out what chain loops worked and what didn't work. And I can't remember what chain loop did. It was terrible, but it was one of the dry loops, one of the graphite dry loops.
Uh-huh.
It left big scars on the chain, and it left a black film crease. It was terrible.
Yeah.
And it came out really bad. Well, we're out doing the testing in the garage. My little 8-year-old kid, Ricky, walks out, and there's this machine just howling away. It's going, making this weird sound. And the kid, who, Dad, what's that? Is that the wind in the darkness machine? And, yep, son, that's the WITD machine, the old Wind in the Darkness machine.
Yeah.
So, anyway, so I didn't think a whole lot about it.
Yeah.
The story came out, and all of a sudden I get a call from Bill Golden to come to the office. And we go to the office, and there's the usual thing. There's the guys, the two guys that own the company from this channel company. And there's a couple of lawyers standing there.
You're like, I've seen this before.
And they're, I've been there so many times to the office. And these guys are bright red. They're just, he says, you, our sales just went, just died. They went to hell, and we can't do anything. And, oh, my God. Blah, blah, blah. And are you an engineer? How do you dare do this? And where do you get off doing this stuff?
Uh-huh.
And they're just getting in my face like you can't believe. And I said, hold it. Just a minute, you guys. I said, first of all, number one, we tested a chain loop using a standard WITD machine.
Yeah.
And
they just look at each other. Yeah, yeah.
The Wind of the Darkness machine.
Yeah.
We didn't say wind.
Yeah.
We use a standard WITD machine.
Yeah.
And the vice president turns to the lawyer and says, well, what's with this WITD machine? The lawyer says, was it a standard one? He says, yes, it was a standard WITD machine, about 2 years old. He says, oh, okay. So I said, so if you want me to take this machine and do it in front of a judge, then we'll do that. But that's where your machine came out.
Yeah.
Your chain worked out on there. You know, standard WITD machine. Anyway, so they left. They just grumbled and left.
Yeah.
So Bill Gold calls me, and he says, when did we get a WITD machine? I said, it's a Wind in the Darkness machine. And he says, you son of a bitch. He says, how can you do this to me? He says, you put my balls on a line. Good Lord.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of stuff we did back then.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think I remember that article. I really think I remember that one. It's that time. Time for a commercial. Sorry, guys. Got to pay the bills.
Thanks for listening to the BTOsports.com podcast show. Please don't forget that BTO is the world leader in aftermarket motocross parts for the bike or body. You'll find deals like a Shoei VFXW helmet for $309.99, 45% off, or Smith Piston goggles for $32.99, 65% off. Your order can be shipped anywhere in the USA for free, or if you're not in the USA, we ship worldwide. Check it out at BTOsports.com.
So what made
you,
what
you,
made
you didn't read that part in the book?
Yeah,
about
exactly.
The WITD machine. Yeah.
What was the worst thing you got in trouble for, all those years?
Oh, the worst thing I got in trouble?
Yeah.
After I was there about 3.5 years the second time.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't making money fast enough because they stole money to distributors and printers.
Yeah.
Okay, big time money. So they brought in Roland Hines is an efficiency expert from New York, and Roland Hines is a guy who owns High Torque now.
Yeah, I thought he owned it. He never always owned it. He didn't start it.
Nope. Bill Golden. Bill Golden owned all that time.
All right.
And so Bill Golden was nothing more than a figurehead and got $50,000 a year. That's all he got.
Yeah.
And all he did was sit in his office, and eventually he just didn't even sit in his office anymore. He was so bummed out because he had no power whatsoever.
And, yeah.
And Roland Hines had all the power in the world. Well, Roland Hines and I we didn't hit it off. Let me to put it mildly, we didn't hit it off.
Yeah.
He was a very, very religious guy.
Yeah.
And he made us go in the office and take all the posters down, all the girls sitting on the bikes with their bikinis and stuff like that. He said, I won't have pornography on the walls. I went, what the hell? These are just girls in bathing suits, you know?
Yeah.
I won't have pornography. Oh, jeez. So anyway, Roland and I, we hit it off real bad. One time, we were going down going out to Indian Dunes, me and Clipper and Webb, and we had this Mako, had the forks on the tailgate of this El Camino I had,
mm-hmm.
and we were doing, rebuilding the forks according to Mako, just modifying these forks. We had taken photos, step at a time, putting these springs in, these spacers, and just modifying these forks to make them really, really, really bitching, right?
Right.
So we had all these tiles on the tailgate. It's a Tuesday at Indian Dunes. And we're working on this thing. We're spraying with contact cleaner. We get it all nice and clean. We're working. And here's Roland Hines who comes up on his little buggy. He has a Volkswagen-powered buggy. He comes up. He spins a big donut. Spins a big donut and covers our forks up.
Yeah.
We had three sets of forks, all completely taken apart on Donnie's tiles.
On the bench, yeah. And, on the back of the El Camino.
On the back of the El Camino. And he covers them with dirt. And I go, Jesus, Mary, and Joseph H. Christ on a public stick. What are you doing? Oh, don't worry about it. So... Well, we finally get them all cleaned up again. We put the one set of forks back on the Mako. I take the Mako, a 450 Mako, and I turn around and I go, boom, 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 boom. Wah! Dump the clutch and spin and throw a bunch of rocks and sand and dirt on Roland Hines, who's sitting in his buggy, and just covered him from head to foot with dust and dirt and rocks and stuff.
Yeah.
And it went downhill from there.
Yeah.
It went completely downhill from there.
That was the beginning of the end.
Yeah, that was the beginning of the end.
So that was, speaking from a test product point of view, what did get you in the most trouble? You know, was it a chain loop thing or was there something else?
Probably the Yamaha, in 1974, the Yamaha SC500 came out, 73 or 74.
Yeah.
Remember the Yamaha SC500? It was a 500 two-stroke single.
I don't remember that, Super Hunky. I was born in 73, so.
Okay. Well, this bike, it answers the question, what did we get when we really, really had to have an ill-handling bike that didn't last long, that blew up with regularity and seized and rattled? And that was the SC500. So we got it for a test, and I took it out, as usual, for an hour and a half desert race. It was the European Scrambles. So I took it out, and I seized like six times. I mean, I'm just going through the smoke bomb, just going, rah, 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 boom, seize. I let it cool down, started up again, took it off, seize. It was a vicious handling motorcycle. it was horrible, and I gave it a really bad test write-up. And the test write-up was like, it's gray and black, so is a turkey. And Jesus Christ, you would think that Yamaha was going to have a coronary. They showed up at the office with about four or five vice presidents, and they were screaming and yelling, "How dare you? What are you, a national champion? Are you a professional rider?" I said, "No, I'm just a grunt. I'm just a normal Sunday grunt." He said, "Well, how do you dare do this?" I said, "Who do you think you sell this motorcycle to? You don't sell this motorcycle to a national champion.
Yeah.
You sell it to people like me and my friends. And this bike's a piece of shit."
Yeah.
And they called me all kind of names. They canceled all the advertising until they came out with a brand new bike, a new monoshock, and we got a great write up on that. And then they loved us again.
Yeah, yeah, that's how it works, right?
Yeah, yeah. And then the same thing happened, and oh gosh, it must have been 70-something, 79, 80. We did a test on the Honda SL175, and. It was the slowest, most pathetic bike I've ever ridden in my life. One of the things that I said in the test was this. I said, "Honda makes no claims for this motorcycle," which we think is extremely accurate. So David Swift was going to take, he said, "Well, Rick," he said, "what am I going to do for photos of this bike?" He said, "It's a real pig." I said, "Well, take a picture with a pig." He goes, "Oh, I know somebody that has an animal farm out in Newhall for the movies."
Uh-huh.
So he goes out to this animal farm where they have all kind of giraffes and lions and bullshit like that.
Yeah.
And they had this pig out there named Dolly the Wonder Pig. It's about a 300-pound white pig that's in a whole lot of commercials and movies and stuff like that. And we put this Honda in the pen right next to this pig. This pig comes over and goes, grunt, 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 grunt. And it looks at this bike. And so David Swift took a picture of it, and we put a picture of Oink coming out of the exhaust pipe of the Honda.
Oh, jeez.
And we ran it as our lead photo for the story.
Right.
And Honda went ballistic. There I was back in the office again.
Yeah, exactly.
Seriously, with vice presidents and lawyers. And we were just terrible. We were horrible.
Yeah.
And then a real good Elsinore came out. We talked about that and real good. And they loved us too.
And then they loved you again. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah. They canceled like $200,000 worth of advertising, you know. They yanked that stuff and gold and said, "Oh, my God, what are we going to do?" I said, "Be quiet. We're making so much money on the amount of magazines alone." See, nowadays, a magazine if it doesn't make money advertising, it doesn't make it.
Right.
All right? All right. In those days, back then, we were selling magazines for 75 cents a copy. Man, we were making money just off the magazine.
Right, right.
Advertising was gravy.
Yeah, nowadays you see the magazines, but the subscriptions are so cheap. They're just dirt cheap, you know?
Yeah, that's what they call giveaway subs.
Yeah. Yeah, it's surprising. It's all magazines, you know?
But if you look at the cover price on a magazine, cover price is like $5.
Right. Right.
It's amazing. Absolutely amazing.
So, what made you leave Dirt Bike in the fall of 85?
Roland Hines and I just kept butting heads real bad.
Yeah.
And one of the things we used to do, this was one of the things that really drove me nuts. The guy got a brand new van. Roland got a brand new van. And he said he went to a gas station and he got brand new tires and wheels for it. He got these really bitchin' tires and wheels for this brand new van. And he stopped by a gas station to get a tank of gas and how much they wanted to change it. They wanted $10 a tire to put it on there. He says, I went to a gas station, you know, and they wanted $40 to put these tires on my car, on my van. That's mm-hmm. terrible. Well, at the time, I was racing a truck. I also had a truck in the Baja 1000 I was racing. And Bronco. So I said, well, Roland, let's bring it over to my house. I said, I got a big jack over there. And I said, bring your thing over. And I said, I'll pop it up in the air and I'll put the tires on it for you.
Right.
Take me, you know, 15 minutes for me. He said, okay. So he shows up in my place in Granada Hills. I take the huge floor jack out and I get the thing up in the air. It's a 100-degree day, 110-degree day in typical L.A.
Yeah.
And I change all four tires and I put the other tires in the back of the van. He pulls out of my lot. He doesn't even say thank you. He doesn't even say thank you.
Yeah.
So
you're like, wow, that's a lot of work.
He doesn't even say thank you. Well, I saw him in the hallway and I called him a prick. And it just went down over there.
That was it. The end.
Then Paul Clipper left, my right hand man. Paul, mm-hmm. Check this out. So he took Webb, with me and Clipper and Webb, we had a really good magazine, all three of us working on it. And Webb was a good AA enduro rider.
Mm-hmm.
And Webb got me into enduros. And I rode a few enduros, but I was never any really good. And I got to the point where I was actually riding the enduros fairly good
mm-hmm.
because we'd ride on the same minute with Webb, and he was an excellent timekeeper.
Right.
And I was riding, you know, like PE-175s and IT-175s, good stuff like that.
Yeah.
And we had a real good time. Me and Clipper and Webb would ride enduros and motocross and desert race. We had a real good time. Then he took Webb off of me, a dirt bike, and put him in charge of dirt wheels.
Oh, yeah.
Now, Webb couldn't stand a four-wheeler.
Yeah.
He couldn't. Far as I'm concerned, four-wheelers are, well, I'll tell you about four-wheelers in a minute. But He put Webb in charge of dirt wheels.
Yeah.
He said, you're never going to have a chance to be in charge of dirt bike. You want to be your own magazine, you're going to put you in charge of dirt wheels.
It's all yours, yeah.
So it leaves me and Clipper. So Clipper got so pissed off at Roland, he had his own run-ins with Roland, that he said, Rick, he says, I got to leave. I got to go. I can't take it anymore. I said, I can understand, man.
Yeah.
So he took off and went to work for KTM.
Uh-huh.
And so he says, I'll give you 3 months. About a month later, I'm sitting in my office one day, and Ketchup Cox walked in. I don't know if you know who he is.
I just know the name. And actually, he sent me an email a little while ago because I broke down every issue of Super Motocross from 1983, and
mm-hmm.
Just for my own website for fun. And he wrote me out of the blue. I have no idea. I said, wow, thanks. So anyway, that's all I know. So.
Well, he's a nice guy, but he is the latest guy as far as ever making a deadline. He always missed deadlines. I refuse to have anything to do with him. He's having work for me. He always worked for Dirt Wheels and did whatever, and he worked for Motocross Action for a while. And he's a nice guy, but just hopelessly incompetent as far as getting stuff done properly and on time. So Harry walks into my office. He sat down and put his feet up on Paul Clipper's desk. He says, hey, Super Hunky, how you doing? I said, yeah, what can I do for you, Ketchup? He says, I'm your new right-hand man. I said, oh, you
wasn't he
are?
Jody's buddy from back in the day, from Texas?
Yeah, yeah. He worked with Jody for a while, and then Jody, you know, we all like Ketchup. Ketchup was a good old boy. But Ketchup, man, I don't think he could fall out of a building and hit the ground on time. I mean, seriously,
yeah.
No shit. He's a wonderful guy. I love him dearly, but and completely incompetent.
So, okay,
anyway,
so he shows up,
So he shows up, he puts his seat up on Clipper's desk, Clipper's ex-desk. He says, I'm your new right-hand man. I said, really? How did this happen? He said, well, he says, I went in and talked to Roland Hines, and he says, he wants me to work with you. He says, I had some great ideas, and I talked to Roland at great lengths. I said, oh, you did you? He says, what I want to do is I want to come here, and I got permission from Roland to incorporate my ideas into Dirt Bike. We can make it grow again. I said, okay, what are your ideas?
Yeah.
Tell me your ideas. He said, well, he said, I looked through all the issues of Dirt Bike, all the way back to 71. I said, yes. He said, in all those issues of Dirt Bike, you never had one story on flat track racing. I said, okay.
Yeah.
He said, and also, you never had one story on ice racing. I said, okay. He said, therefore, he says, we're missing the whole crowd. What we're going to do then, I talked to Roland. He said, it's okay. He says, you're supposed to go along with it. We're going to have a couple stories every month on flat track racing and ice racing in the magazine. That's what we're going to do. We're going to get that whole crowd of people. I said, Ketchup, before I kill you, and they take me away and put me in jail for like 40 years for killing someone.
Yeah.
I want you to realize in all the years that I was editor of Dirt Bike Magazine, I got thousands and thousands and thousands of letters.
Mm-hmm.
Never once in all those letters that I ever got did I ever get anyone requesting anything on dirt on flat track racing, ever. And not only did I not get a letter on ice racing, I never even dreamed about ice racing. I said, if you ever went to Ascot in its heyday and you went in the parking lot of Ascot, all you saw in the parking lot was Gold Wings, Harley 74 dressers, and stuff like that. These people are not the guys that go out on a weekend and ride a YZ250 or whatever. They just don't do it. I said, that's a whole different crowd. It's not even a dirt bike crowd. You can't talk to them. He said, no, we're going to do it. I said, okay, here's the deal. I said, Ketchup, you better get on down the hallway. I said, you better get out of my sight, because if you're within my sight within the next 2 minutes, I'm going to go to jail. There's no question about it. And so I got this message from Roland Hines that I was supposed to listen to Ketchup, and I sent my letter of resignation in an hour later.
Really?
That was it.
I called
Clipper up, and Clipper just laughed his ass off. He said, yeah, I figured it'd take you 3 months. It took you 1 month exactly, and you're gone.
Yeah, yeah. So what did you do after Dirt Bike?
Well, I had been making some phone calls. I talked to George Elliott down at Argus Publications. He used to do Pop Cycling.
Uh-huh.
And I said, why don't we revive Pop Cycling? He said, no, come on down. I want to talk to you. And I went down and talked to him. And Off-Road Magazine had just lost their editor named Mike Parrish.
Mm-hmm.
And he went to Ford as a PR guy at Ford. And they needed somebody to run Off-Road Magazine. Well, Off-Road Magazine was all about trucks and whatever, 4x4s.
Right.
And I didn't know a 4x4 from anything. I couldn't tell a Bronco from a Blazer.
You had a Bronco in Baja, but...
Yeah, well, I had the Bronco shortly thereafter.
Yeah,
time period was off. So anyway, I took over Off-Road Magazine, and sure enough, man, I started racing a Trooper in 86. I ran a Baja 1000, won Class 14 in a Zuzu Trooper.
Yeah.
And,
Trooper.
You know, the amazing the amazing thing was, we did a story on the Zuzu racing team. It was Mike Leone, the guy on Mike Sarans, Jose Javier Tesnado, and Jose Luna. And we did a story on all three of those guys and the Zuzu racing team, which is three Zuzu trucks, two Pups and a Trooper.
Mm-hmm.
And went out and did a thing with them in Riverside, California at the track. The trucks were being built by K-Cars. And so I made an arrangement with the guys that I was going to do the story on these three guys in the Zuzu team, but I would like to be able to drive one of the race trucks. And
right.
Okay. The fact that I was a motocrosser, an accomplished motocrosser, that sort of opened the door.
Right.
It just wasn't some clown off the street.
Yeah, exactly.
So they had about a 7-mile course out there they were taking lap times on. Well, I got in one of their pups, Tisnado's pup, and within a couple of laps, I was turning faster lap times than they were. And I'm not that I'm a great racer, but yeah. Don't forget, a motorcycle rider.
Yeah, motocross.
A motorcycle rider reads the terrain better than a guy who just drives trucks.
Yeah.
So what I'd do, I'd go over a little rise with a couple little bumps in, and make a double jump out of a small double jump out. I'd only go 15 feet through the air.
Right.
But those guys would hit both bumps, and you know, taking a corner wide and driving across a corner, stuff like that, where they wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
And I was 5 or 6 seconds a lap faster than they were after a few laps. And anyway, in the Baja 500, all three of the Isuzu trucks did terrible. And I talked to the people who were doing their advertising, worked out a deal with them, and got a sponsor, a Ralph Lauren's Polo.
Nice.
And did the Baja 1000 and made the truck into Ralph Lauren colors.
Right.
And we won class 14. It was really great.
Sweet.
I raced that a few more races and Mickey Thompson's races and stuff like that, and sold it and built the Bronco, a big oldie 2, and had a great time with that. Had a wonderful time racing. It did, 4 years of Baja racing, mid 400, Gold Coast, San Felipe 250. It was a very, very good 10 years. I learned an incredible amount, an awesome amount. I learned more than I ever wanted to know.
Exactly.
The amount of work required to race and maintain an off-road vehicle is just it's not to be believed.
Believed. Always tinkering, always fixing, always trying to look for a better way.
And I was very lucky in that because I had a magazine at my disposal, I was able to get good sponsor money. I get $85,000-$90,000 a year sponsor money, but at the end of the year, I look at my checking account to be like $800 left in it. And I go, what happened to all the money?
Right. It's that time. Time for a commercial. Sorry, guys. Got to pay the bills.
Thanks for listening to the BTOsports.com podcast show. Please don't forget that BTO is the world leader in aftermarket motocross parts for the bike or body. You'll find deals like a Shoei VFXW helmet for $309.99, 45% off, or Smith Piston goggles for $32.99, 65% off. Your order can be shipped anywhere in the USA for free, or if you're not in the USA, we ship worldwide. Check it out at btosports.com.
You still keep in touch with Clipper and Webb? Webb's back at Dirt Bike, I think. Clipper has his own magazine in the Northeast there.
Trail Rider. In fact, I write for of all things now. Would you believe it? I write a column for Trail Rider.
Oh, do you? Okay, all right.
Yeah, and the Clipper and I go way back.
Right.
So we're staying good touch, stay in touch with guys like Krause, and we have a good old time.
Mr. Know It All was good. He was funny. I always thought that was you though.
No, that was Vic Krause
from Sidewinder. From Sidewinder Sprockets.
Sidewinder Sprockets.
Yeah.
In fact, I thought the name up. We were coming back to the Cincinnati Trade Show in Vic Krause's motorhome, and there was about a foot of snow on the highway and blue ice, and we're coming back in his motorhome, just completely all over the all. We thought we were going to die. So the only thing we could do, we stopped and got a case of beer and a couple buckets of chicken.
And why not? Right?
Yeah, we proceeded to drive down the highway drinking beer and eating chicken, and that's what we Mr. Know-It-All, that's what I came up with the name and came up with the concept.
Uh-huh.
You know, something completely arrogant, completely snotty, and that's how it came out. It worked out really, really good.
What's your take on Dirt Bike today?
Dirt Bike today is, well, let me put it to you this way.
Yeah.
A few months ago, I picked up a copy of Dirt Bike. I get comped for a whole lot of magazines, okay? I get my mailbox stuffed with magazines. I picked up a copy of Dirt Bike, and there on the cover, it said, exclusive 40 pages of hot new products. On the cover, on the left-hand side, which you're supposed to, that's where you're supposed to put your type because that's how they stack magazines, it says 40 pages of hot new products. And I sat there, and I just slumped to a chair. Slumped to a chair. Because if one of my editors would have... we're going to put 40 pages of an editorial fellatio on the cover, I would have thrown him out of the office. It would have left skid marks on the way out.
Yeah.
And that's what would have happened.
Yeah.
I mean, I couldn't not believe. And I looked inside, and there indeed was 40 pages of nothing but strokes on all these baloney products. I mean, $900 titanium mufflers for a CR450. Give me a goddamn break. Excuse my language, but give me a goddamn break. You spend $8,000 on a bike, and they want you to spend another $900 on a titanium muffler that saves, 1.2 pounds. Ooh, 1.2 pounds. That's going to really improve my lap times a great deal.
Yeah.
I just could not believe it. I just absolutely couldn't believe it. And I looked at that, and I just shook my head, and I said, what has happened to this publication?
Right. Yeah, I don't know either, to be honest. It's been a while since I read Dirt Bike, which is amazing because it was once a must-read. You know?
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. you could find stuff in there that would piss you off. Mm-hmm. You could find stuff in there you could agree with, but you could always find the truth. You could find what bikes really put out in horsepower, what they really weighed. But let me give you an example about today. One of my really pet peeves, are the new bikes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now this February, the end of this February, I'm going to be 70. Okay?
Yeah.
And I just recovered from a radiation treatment to recover from the prostate.
I was going
to
ask how you're doing. How's your health holding up? Because there was a scare back.
I'm doing okay. I dropped 27 pounds. I've been training, and I had a knee replacement and the whole thing. And I'm training again. I'm down at 215, 214, and I'm riding again, and I'm going to start racing vintage in the over 70 class.
Oh, cool.
In the end of February.
Right on.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. And I'm going out and riding again, and, man, I'm slow. I'm so slow. It's the thing. But, you know, you got to start somewhere. So I go out with my buddy, Tim, and we go out and we ride. We got plenty of land here in Arizona. Just beautiful. Anywhere you go, you can go riding.
Right.
As long as you use your head. Anyway, so we went out riding, and one of his friends has a 2009 450 Kawasaki, and he went with us.
Right.
And I let the guy ride my 490 Mako.
Oh, you still got one, huh?
I got an 83 490. Now, the 81 490 is considered by many to be the greatest motorcycle
yes.
ever made.
Yes.
But the 83 490, most people don't realize it because it was tested so rarely that was in the death knolls of Mako. The 83 490 was actually about 8 horsepower more than the 81 490. It was absolutely brutal. It was so fast, it was violent.
Uh-huh.
It takes your breath away. It weighs 226, and it's so much horsepower, you can't believe it. For example, the 81 490 was a straight piston port. The 83 had a reed valve in it. It didn't have a primary chamber. It had a very small bottom end and a huge fins and the whole thing. It's so fast, it's scary. This guy rode my 490, and he just shook his head. And I rode his 450, which is a typical four-stroke 450, and it's pretty fast in the whole thing.
Right.
But it wasn't as fast as my 490. And I'm going to myself, what in the hell is wrong with the way motorcycles are today? This guy spent about $8,000 by the time tax title and, you know, he cleared the dealer's door. And you know what's going to cost this guy to rebuild his 490? His 450,
his
rather?
450, yeah.
His 450 Kawasaki. Guess what it's going to cost him?
Quite a bit.
Okay. Yeah, how about we really, really tell you what quite a bit is. Okay, in the Honda manual, for the 450 Honda, it says 15 hours, you're ready for a rebuild, and if you're a pro,
yeah,
pro or an expert, and 30 hours for normal riding. That's what it says in the manual.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you rebuild it, you're going to have to rebuild not just the head, the top end, but you're going to have to do the rod and the whole thing. It does not include the clutch to gearbox.
Right.
The average cost, about $3,200.
Wow.
Yeah. So imagine if you just go riding with your buddies.
Yeah.
And you've got a 450 whatever.
Yeah, it could be anything. They're all about 30 hours, I'm sure. You know,
that's right.
For an average guy, yeah.
You're going to get more time out of a KTM. KTMs do not turn 13,500 RPM like the rest of them do.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know that? The KTMs are more reliable just because they don't explore the outer limits of piston speed. And it's how can a guy who goes riding couple times a month all year long, mm-hmm. afford three rebuilds during a year out of an $8,000 bike already.
Yeah, on top of the bike price, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, and then they still want you to put $800 mufflers and titanium headpipes and $200 for this, $400 for that. You know, I'm sorry, they have taken all the fun out. On my 490 Mako, I'll put rings in at the end of a year just because I feel guilty.
Yeah.
Seriously.
You're like, I should do something to this thing.
Yeah, I should do something. I'll be nice to it. I'll give it a set of rings.
Right.
And a set of rings is going to cost me $40.
Yeah.
All right.
Gaskets.
And gaskets, that's it.
Yeah. So I take it you're not. It must be weird, though, for a guy that's been around as long as you to see four strokes being the only machine of choice, two strokes coming over and them being the machine of choice, and now it's back full circle again, right? Because,
yeah.
I mean, it must be kind of strange a little bit.
Well, it's sad and it's sick. It shows you the total blithering incompetence of the AMA. The AMA, by and large, with their stupid rules, making 125s run against 254 strokes and so forth, created that problem in their own.
Well,
you're right.
Yeah,
they had 250.
Go ahead.
If you had 252 strokes running against 254 strokes, there wouldn't be a two stroke in the top 15.
Four-stroke in the top 15.
And if you took something like a 490 Mako and made it real narrow and real modern and put disc brakes front and rear and was 206 pounds ready to go,
uh-huh.
And it 62 horsepower, it would just crap all over a 450 anything.
Yeah.
With fuel injection and maps and computers. Good Christ.
Yeah.
I mean, give me a flying break. They've ruined the sport. They have absolutely ruined the sport and taken it completely out of the genre of fun.
Right.
And now you have nothing but a bunch of little punk kids with rings in their ears and tattoos in their neck and their baseball caps on sideways and little sullen little pictures in their ads and their multicolored riding gear, green bikes and red gear and orange helmets with flames and lightning bolts. It looks like a Western auto blew up. I swear to God, it's very sad. That's why I love vintage racing so much.
Right.
I just love it. You go out to the racetrack, and guess what? There's no guys walking around with boom boxes. There's no guys walking around with bolts in their noses and earrings and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, the only tattoos you see are the guy that says USMC on his sleeve or something like that. That's about all you see. But it's just normal people.
Yeah, my brother's all into vintage racing right now. Has himself two 1981 YZs and just loves it. Loves it. My comeback to you would be, and I'm not saying I'm not disagreeing with you, my comeback to you would be that you could make an argument that when the four strokes came out, not just the kids, but the vet riders embraced them and bought them because they're easy, they're lazy, they're easy to ride. They make you a lazy rider. You can clear anything you want at your local track. Just sit down, leave it in third, you know. The public almost kind of spoke with their pocketbook, and now they're realizing that, oops, maybe we shouldn't have, because early on, Yamaha couldn't keep those things in stock.
Okay, let me ask you a question.
Sure.
Do you go to the races on Sunday?
Yes. Well, they're now on Saturdays, but yeah.
On Saturdays or Sundays, whatever you go. When's the last time you saw a 4 or 5 year old four-stroke out there competing?
I don't know. I mean, I go to the pro stuff, so I mean, you never see. But
they're just not there.
Yeah.
Because a 4 or 5 year old four stroke is worth $1,500, and it costs $2,000-$3,000 to rebuild it.
Yeah, you see on Craigslist all the time, because I'm looking for an older bike right now, I mean, mid-80s, but you see all the time on Craigslist, hey, blown-up CRF 450.
That's right. In fact, one of the really, really cool things you can do nowadays, this is really, really cool,
mm-hmm.
is take one of the new four-strokes that is absolutely blown up that you cannot afford to fix, like a 2004 KX, YZ, they're all the same. In fact, if you painted a YZ green and you painted a CR yellow and you painted a RM blue, you couldn't tell one from the other.
No, it's tough. It's tough.
You couldn't really tell one from the other. You absolutely could not. I mean, my God, I can remember looking at a Bultaco. A Bultaco looked like a bull.
Right.
A Mako looked like a Mako. A CZ looked like a CZ. Not... It's like the modern cars of today. Anyway, I'm digressing, but you take a chassis, a perfectly good chassis, really bitchin' wheels, a good frame, good brakes, good suspension, and there's a blown-up motor in that is such a piece of crap that you can't afford to fix it. All right, you take that thing and take the motor out and use it as a doorstop in your garage, or sell whatever few parts you can get on eBay.
Yeah.
And then you put your CR500, your YZ250, or whatever kind of motor you want, two-stroke motor, in there.
Yeah.
In there, and you've got a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful motorcycle.
Do you see a day when the two-strokes come back? What's your thoughts on that?
I see a day somehow when the industry has enough common sense to make another version of the DT1.
Mm-hmm.
The DT1, I don't know if you were born in 73.
Yeah, 73, but I do know the history of the DT1. Yeah, very important motorcycle.
Well, I'll tell you why it was important. I was in a Dirt Diggers Motorcycle Club way back then. And guys, we had the usual array of crap that we rode. I mean, we had 441 Victors and Triumphs and Greaves and all kinds of crap, all right, which we all rode around. Most of the time, we came back to end of a tow rope. When the DT1 came out, it was $749, and you could let it sit in your garage for 2 months. It was starting the first or second kick, and it was reliable.
Mm-hmm.
It was dead simple. It was cheap to work on. It was fun to ride, and it handled not too great, but you can make it work a little better by putting little odds and ends in it.
Right.
But you had a sensible bike at a reasonable price, and it was fun, and most guys don't race. I'll tell you, if you stand along, where do you live at? In L.A.?
I live in Vegas.
Okay. In L.A., if you stand along Highway 5,
yep,
going out of L.A. north.
Going like a Magic Mountain way, going north, yeah.
You got it. And you stand along the highway right about before dawn, you see a bunch of guys going out there with the trucks and trailers. And on the trucks and trailers, you're going to see all kinds of bikes heading out to go have fun.
Right.
All right? And you look at all the bikes that are going out there. And for every bike you see with a number plate on, the guy's going to the races. I mean, a real number plate.
Right.
Where a guy's going to the races somewhere. You see 100 5 or 6 or 7 or 10 or 12-year-old ITs or YZs or God knows what else, piece of crap, XRs, and they're going out to have fun with their buddies.
Right.
Because they can afford to do it and they can have fun.
I agree with that,
That's what the real world is, and nobody is paying attention to these guys. Nobody. No one. Look, the whole bottom line is this. The real bottom line is this. You have a magazine. Your magazine is ABC Motocross Magazine, okay?
Right.
And you do a test on a new Kawasaki 450,
mm-hmm,
all right? If you don't have a Kawasaki 450, you don't care. You'll look at it with cursory examination,
mm-hmm,
and that's all you're going to do. If you've got an RM 450 four-stroke, you really could care less. You might look at it with curiosity, but you're not about to buy it. You can't afford to. They're ignoring the fact that for every new bike sold, there's a thousand old bikes out there that people put gas in and go riding. They buy handlebars for it. They
right.
buy chains, sprockets. They buy grips. They buy filters. They buy all the things that you need. Guys like Works Performance Company are still in business selling shocks.
Yeah.
Because they make shocks for bikes that people ignore.
Yeah.
we are seeing a complete ignorance on the part of most magazines, of that tremendous, tremendous market out there that exists. We are seeing that.
Right, right. Yeah, no, like I said, my brother's into it now, so he's found all these websites and stores that specialize in vintage stuff and YZ stuff, and he's all about it now, you know, and it's a whole underground sort of industry going on. And, you know, hopefully, yeah, one day it comes. I mean, I admire KTM and Yamaha. They're sticking to the two-strokes. They're producing new models every year, some minor updates, but the bikes are pretty good as it is. So I admire those two companies for keeping it up, right?
And the nice thing is, you can ride all year long your Yamaha 250 two-stroke all year long.
Yeah.
And nothing's going to go wrong with it. Nothing's going to go wrong. You maybe put chain sprockets, tires, that's about it.
Yeah.
You know?
And actually, even four-strokes eat chains and sprockets like it's no one's business. So that's another part that's more money, you know, is the maintenance of a four-stroke. So.
Well, you call that. You absolutely call that. Well, right now in my garage, I have my 83 490 Mako.
Yeah.
I have a CRF 230 four-stroke.
Yep.
Electric start. And I've got upside-down forks on it, good shocks. I've made a project bike out of it.
Yeah, fiddled around
with it. And it works really, really good. It has about the same kind of horsepower, same kind of pull as a 350 XR.
Mm-hmm.
And it's electric start, and with my titanium knee, I walk with. I have a TT 230 Yamaha, also electric start. I keep that in the garage, a pair of those. And I also have in my garage, absolutely flawless. You could eat off of it. 1976 Mako Grand Prix AW 400.
I don't know what that is.
It's got the aluminum tank, hot tank.
Yeah.
It's the 8-off wild replica.
Okay.
And I got that sitting in my garage, and it's never even been started. I feel really embarrassed about it. I look at it, and I go, nope.
Not today.
Let that baby sit. It's like having a 57 Chevy convertible in your garage.
Right. Oh, that sounds pretty cool. What about pro racing? You know, my job is a journalist covering, I don't use the word journalist lightly, but covering the Supercrosses and Nationals. I go to every one of them and report back to people on what happened, who did what. How much do you follow today's racing?
Well, I look at Supercross, but by and large, it bores me to tears.
Yeah.
the outdoor motocross, I find it quite interesting. I still look at that.
Yeah.
And I find when they run on a course like Unadilla or Redbud or something, to me, that's real racing.
Yeah.
So Supercross racing, excuse me, jump, hoop-de-doo, jump, hoop-de-doo, jump, hoop-de-doo.
Right.
Give me a flaming break.
Uh-huh.
I mean, what could be more boring in the world than watch a guy jump? If you jump too far, you get hurt. If you don't jump far enough, you get hurt.
Yeah, that pretty much sums it up.
Jesus Christ. The only place that the guy can pass is the end of a long hoop-de-doo section. You leave it on a little bit long, the other guy, and you pass him. You maybe pull a half a second on that guy. That's it. That's James Stewart especially. And, of course, we'll see what happens to James Stewart this weekend.
Yeah, definitely. He hit the ground. He hit the ground hard.
But like he would say when he hit the ground, James, how are you feeling? Well, you know, I don't feel too good, you know.
Yeah, we covered that.
You know.
Hey, what about when you were the editor of Dirt Bike or any of the magazine or the other magazine? How was your relationship with the pro guys? I mean, did you have to write critical things sometimes and have them come down on you? I mean,
I got along great with the guys. One of the things I used to do was I used to take the European writers, especially the Europeans. They wanted to go out in the California desert.
Mm-hmm.
They would come over to the place and visit Aki Janssen, Adolf Wild, Garrett Wilson, guys like that. And they'd say, we wanted to see the desert because, you know, if they're from Germany or Belgium or something like that, there is no open land over there.
No.
There's nothing. I mean, if you don't know a farmer where you can use a little bit of his land to go riding on or a private track, you don't ride. You just don't go out in the woods somewhere and just go ride your motorcycle.
Yeah.
Because if you do, you will be in jail that night post-haste.
Yeah.
So they could not believe that we still had the open desert out there. So I would take the guys out to the desert all the time. And they thought it was absolutely fantastic. They had more fun. Give an example. One time we had Adolf Weil, Garrett Wolfsink, Willy Bauer, a couple other guys, three top German writers.
Like they were here for the Trans-Ams or Trans-Am?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they came in town for the USGP in Carlsbad.
Okay.
And they came about a week early, and they said, hey, we want to go to the desert. I said, okay. So they wanted to take their three mechanics with them, too. So I took a couple of my guys, and I took a whole I showed up at my house. I had a whole garage full of test bikes. So everybody grabbed a test bike, all right?
Yeah.
You don't want to take your personal factory Mako.
Right.
Go try riding in the desert. So we all grabbed bikes. So So all the guys grabbed the 500s and 250s, and then we had all we had left were 125s. And Carl Hines is one of the mechanics for the Mako guys. And I said, Carl, there's 125 Suzuki, RM125, what do you want? He says, I don't ride no 125. I ride men's bike. 125 is day for pussies. I go, okay.
All right.
What do you want to ride? He says, this I ride that. He points to this 350 Honda. And it was the one that had the headlights on, two black low pipes.
Now, like an XL, kind of?
It was like an XL 350.
Yeah.
And I said, whoa. I said, hey, you don't want to ride that, Carl. We're going out to the desert. There's hoopty-doos and sand. This thing weighs 325 pounds. It's got a headlight, and it's got mirrors and turn signals, and it's got everything. He says, nah, Honda, they make a good bike. I ride this bike. This is the bike I ride. Okay, so I had about an 18-foot trailer, and we had a couple of vans. And so I got all the guys together, and we took off this big procession out to the Ponderosa, which is about 16 miles of east of Palmdale, and one of my favorite riding areas. So we go out there, and Carl, he just has a set of boots and gloves and goggles and a helmet, and he's in just a shirt and pants. He wouldn't even put gear on. We're all putting our gear on, and Carl takes his Honda, and he takes the mirrors. There's two mirrors on it. Now, you got to picture this. I don't know if you ever saw the way Honda used to put their trail bikes with the mirrors on. They had about an inch and a half of threaded stock sticking out of the bottom. Well, Carl pushed the mirrors forward so they wouldn't be in the way.
Right.
But there's a threaded stock sticking out of the back. Well, he goes about 30 yards to the hoops while we're still loading up. We're still getting our gear on.
Everybody's still just chilling, right?
Yeah, we're still getting our goggles and
yeah.
all that stuff. And he goes, boom, boom, hits the hoops, and bam, asshole over teacups. I mean, he does a big flaming endo. He comes back, and his blood just pouring out of his neck. And what he did, when he went over to bars, he caught his neck on the threaded stock for the mirror, which was turned around the wrong way, and he just sliced himself right across the neck, and just cut his neck wide open. So we went, whoa, holy smoke. So we wrapped it up with somebody had a towel. We wrapped it up real good. And one of my guys said, well, you guys keep riding. Go ahead. I'll take him into Palmdale Hospital. We'll get him all fixed up. You guys keep riding.
Yeah.
So we said, okay, yeah, well, we're here. We might as well do that. So me and Adolf Weil and Wolsink, and we all rode around, had a good old time, took to the hoops, and they just loved it. The fact that there was all this land, they could just ride and have fun. We just had the most bitchin' time you can imagine. About 3 hours later, Carl Hines shows back up, 37 stitches in his neck.
Jesus, really?
37 stitches, yeah. He shows up. He goes, okay, now I ride. We go, hey, you're all stitched up. He goes, that's nothing. He takes a towel, wraps around his neck, a clean towel. Then he puts duct tape around a towel until he's like the mummy. He can't even move his neck.
Yeah.
He puts a helmet on, and he rides until dark.
Damn.
He rode until dark.
Yeah.
I mean, that is one tough guy. And he rode. Yeah. He took the mirrors off the Honda, by the way.
Yeah, yeah. well, hey, was there one race that stood out for you all these years? Was there a race that was just unbelievable, amazing? Anything?
Actually, the place I was talking about where Carl took the 37 stitches in his neck was called the Ponderosa, and the Ponderosa was. It was nothing but just real deep, gnarly hoops in one lake bed. And it was a place that I went out and rode my first desert race ever in California. And I got everybody beat me. I mean, the whole doctors were passing me, and it was terrible. And I started racing it, and me and my buddy Tom would go out there all the time. You'd go out there and race on Saturdays and Sundays, two weekends a month. And it was three 11-mile loops, and they changed the loops a little bit. By and large, it was the same course all the time. And it was 33 miles, all hoops. Well, I got to the point where I was a dirt bike for a good long time, and I had a 501 Mako that Adolf Weil had dialed in for me. And I had so much horsepower, I couldn't believe it. And I won like 13 in a row overall at the Ponderosa.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because there was no skill required. It was just hang on and hit it.
Yeah, yeah.
a sharp turn was like north to east.
Right.
So there was no skill required. So I was real strong. That's how I got the name, Super Hunky. You know, I was a weightlifter.
Oh, was that it? Really?
Oh, you didn't know that?
No, I had no idea. It should have been one of my questions. It wasn't, though.
Yeah, you want to hear that story?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I was in a club called the Dirt Diggers Motorcycle Club. This is back in 68. And after the club meeting was over, we used to go to a place called the Sneaky Fox. And we'd sit there and drink beer and shuffleboard and eat greasy French fries, 30-weight French fries and whatever. And just had a good old time. And then we eventually find our way home. So we go over there one Wednesday after the meeting, and we walk to the Sneaky Fox. And a bartender says, "Are you guys here for the arm wrestling contest?"
Mm-hmm.
And we said, "Oh, we didn't know there was one." He said, "Yeah." He says, "I had an arm wrestling contest." And I was an Olympic weightlifter. I did over 300-pound press and the whole thing.
Uh-huh.
And okay, Rick, go ahead. So anyway, we started arm wrestling. There's all kind of people in there. And the entry fee was a pitcher of beer, which is $4.
Yeah.
And I won 78 pitches of beer for the club.
Nice.
So everybody's pat me on the back, and we got credit for 78 pitches of beer.
Yeah.
So we proceeded to start to put a dent in the 78 pitcher credit, and we're sitting there drinking beer. And just about the time we're about ready to go home, here comes a whole bunch of football players from the UCLA football team.
Uh-huh.
They walk in. Big guys. These are really big tackles and stuff like that. But this is before football players lifted weights.
Uh-huh.
They were just big.
Yeah.
All right?
Yeah.
So they said, "Hey, we came here for the for the arm wrestling contest." And the bartender says, "Hey, it's all over. Sorry, pal.
That guy's the winner."
there's the guy that's the winner. There's his trophy. I had a little 6-inch trophy. And 70-some pitchers of beer. He says, "Well, if you want to go with him for some pitches, you go right ahead." They said, "Yeah, we'll go with him." So we started arm wrestling all these guys, and we started arm wrestling each other. Typical elimination thing. Two guys go, one guy loses, he's out. And it got down to two guys left, me and this big tackle. This guy was 335 pounds. Well, I'm a 200 pounder, and I'm very strong. But, I mean, 335, this guy's going to kick my ass, right?
Right.
But I looked at his arms, and they were sort of soft arms. You look at them, you can tell there's no muscle tone in the arms.
Yeah.
I mean, he had big legs and big back and all that stuff. So the bartender put his hand up, and he's getting ready to count down. And the minute he touched our hand to go, I just put everything I had in, and I busted this guy's back of his hand open on a table.
Oh, man.
And he's getting ready to kick my ass. I said, "Hey, wait a minute. I said, I'll buy you a pitcher of beer. He said, "Okay." So anyway, we won some more pitches of beer for us. And I came to the next meeting the Wednesday, and there was a white sweatshirt there. And one of the guys had crude letter on it, super hunky. And that's how the nickname stuck.
Yeah. That's the sweater we've seen in the Oh, interesting.
It ain't exactly a glorious story, but that's how it happened, man.
Good story. But another thing I wanted to ask you about on my list of questions is in our sport, MXA and Jody Weisel in particular are a little controversial at times. Jody's kind of a calls it as he sees it guy, not always at the races, but some people don't like it. Thoughts on MXA and Jody? I mean, you probably go way back with the guy.
Mm-hmm. Way back. In fact, Jody and I get along better now than we did way back then.
Yep.
Because way back in the early days, we'd find Jody in the dirt bike office stealing our photos.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But we get along pretty good now. In fact, dirt bike has been passed by Motocross Action Circulation.
Yeah. Yeah. So what do you think about MXA and all that?
Actually, Jody... I don't like the style that he writes. For example, every test that he writes, he asks the same musical questions. Does it handle? Does it stop? Does it break? That gets pretty damn old after a while.
Uh-huh.
You know, let's have a normal lead. Let's have a lead, an intro, talk about the motorcycle, talk about the way it handles. The question thing gets really old. But by and large, he does exactly call the shots, except he still is too easy on the Hondas.
Yeah.
For example, the 2009 Honda, mm-hmm. the 2009 Honda 450.
Right.
Everybody who knows that bike will tell you that the bike has a hiccup, it has a big hesitation when it leaves a jump.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody ever said that in the test.
Right.
No, nobody ever said it. They said it after the fact when the 2010s are about to come out again.
Yeah, yeah.
Not even Jody said it. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that the early dirt bike would have been said.
Right. Yeah, you would have brought that up. Interesting.
Yeah, would have brought it up. It made the bike terrible.
You go grab a pig from a local farm.
Think about that.
Yeah.
You're a 16 or 17 year old kid riding your 450 Honda,
mm-hmm.
and you're at the local supercross track, and the bike hesitates when you're trying to make about a 45 foot double.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. you don't need that trip in the ambulance.
Yeah. No doubt about it. Another thing I want to touch on too was. Now, I'm not that familiar with it. I'm Canadian, so I never had to worry about this problem. But you've long been an advocate for land use, and your battles with the Sierra Club are legendary. Where are we at today, 2010, with our land battles? Where are we at? What's going on? Thoughts on it and all that?
Well, number one, you can forget California. California, which was a hotbed of having a place to ride, you can just forget about that. It's just about closed down. All the money that's been collected for the green stickies and all that stuff for the ride is you don't have their land. You have less than 1% of the land that was available for riding on is available to you now.
Really?
You're now crowded into a few small areas. Sidewinder Road, things like that. A little place up in Gorman, odds and ends here and there, not much. What they do is the people go out and look at this place, and all the people are compressed in this one tiny area, and they see tracks all over the place, and they go, "Oh, what the hell is this? There's tracks all over." Mm-hmm. Oh, really? Could that be because this is the only place we can ride?
Yeah.
It's gotten to the point. That's one of the reasons I left for Mexico.
Was it really?
You know,
yeah.
I want you to think about this a second. The United States is supposed to be the land of the free. I had left the United States to go to a country called Mexico where I can have a little freedom.
Yeah, scary. Scary.
It is scary. When you think about the fact that you can go virtually anywhere you want to go in Mexico if you use your head. If you strafe some guy's cows and he shoots you, well,
yeah.
Tough. All right, you deserve it.
Mexico is a little bit of a scary place, though, that way, right? A little frontier justice.
Actually, by and large, if you stay away from the borders,
yeah.
if you don't go to Nogales or Tijuana or anything like that, you're inland a bit. You're down. It's okay. It's a good place.
You're all right.
As long as all the border cities, in fact, most countries in the world, and I've been all around the world, most countries in the world, most border cities are pure trash.
Yeah. Yeah. Huh. Interesting. So we're still battling it, huh? We're still. But nobody's
battling. The AMA, I'll give you one example. When Lewis McKay and I had the Sahara Club, we took the name Sahara Club as the name that would piss off the Sierra Club the most.
Yeah.
That they sued us like you can't believe, and we won.
Yeah.
But when we decided that was the end of the Sahara Club, I had to do in Lewis moved to Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
And we had all these great pictures, all these great photos, and all this great information, tons of stuff, and we offered it to the AMA. We offered it to the AMA for free, and their so-called battle against the land use people.
Yeah.
And they said, no, we don't want it. We said, well, we just want to give it to you. We don't want any money for it. We don't want anything.
Yeah.
No, we can't accept anything from you guys. Well, why is that? Because you people are radical, and if we found out that you did it, we would never hear the end of it. I said, wait a minute. We're actually on your side.
Yeah.
We're for you. We want to give you something for free.
Yeah.
And they said, no. Let me tell you something that most people don't know about. This is something that was not in my book. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
The first time we went to federal court, Lewis McKay and I were both served about 3-inch thick pieces of paper with all kind of criminal charges on us. They wanted huge fines. They wanted us to go to jail and for conspiracy and everything else. One of the things that you don't realize, if you rob a bank Let's say the penalty for robbing a bank is 7 years.
Yeah.
All right? If you rob a bank, that's your penalty if you get caught.
Yeah.
If you conspire to rob a bank with someone else, that's conspiracy, and it's automatically double
really?
The sentence.
Really? Huh.
Yeah.
Didn't know that.
Okay. So what they did, all the things that the charges they gave us were all for conspiracy. Me and Lewis conspired to break all these laws, so the fines and the sentences would be double.
Right. Oh, okay.
Okay. So, anyway, so we decided, well, we had to go to federal court. Well, me and Lewis McKay, the Phantom Duck of the Desert,
yep.
We put our houses on the line to get the money for a lawyer. One time, we were $300,000 in a hole between the two of us.
Yeah.
Yeah. And luckily, I was the editor of a magazine. I was able to raise the money, you know.
Right.
And through the magazine. But here's what happened. We go to federal court for the first time. And me and Lewis walk in with our attorney. And there is 13 federal attorneys and 118 witnesses.
Jesus.
And I just about crapped myself. I went, holy smoke, what's this? I just realized at that point just how serious these people were.
Yeah.
And I also realized they had unlimited funds, whereas we didn't. Me and Lewis, we had our houses. We had our homes.
Right.
Our homes were on the line. And they could literally break us just by time alone.
Yeah.
Break us.
Yeah. Yeah.
So anyway, the court dragged on and on. Every day the guy was there, the lawyer cost us $150 an hour, and it was more and more, and it dragged out. And we were just getting burnt out, completely burnt out. Okay, so one of the things that happened was this. This is the big thing that happened. This is the huge thing. I got a call one night, and it says, Rick Simon? I said, yes.
Yep.
It's about 8 o'clock at night. He says, meet me at the Department of Water and Power downtown parking lot on the second floor. I'm a friend. I have something for you. I said, well, ho, who is this?
You're like, yeah, right. This is like out of the movies. It's like out of the movies.
Yeah, it's like some kind of a spy novel, like a cheap spy novel.
Right.
And he says, no, this is, you just show up. I got something for you.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I want to bring the duck with me. He says, that's fine. He says, but don't ask who I am. He said, we just got something for you.
Yeah.
So I called Louie up. I said, Louie, they want to meet us down there. They got something for us. He said, well, let's go. Yeah. So we were supposed to meet at 11 o'clock. We got down a little bit early. And the parking lot is virtually empty because, you know, nobody's there except a few night watchmen and stuff like that.
Right.
So we're on the second floor. There's like three cars there. And me and Lewis are sitting in our car. And this car pulls up. And there's mud on the license plate. You can't see the number.
Yeah.
I go, okay.
Yeah.
This is straight out of a Robert Ludlum book.
Yeah.
So the guy walks out, and he's got a jacket with a collar pulled up. He's got a hat on with the baseball hat pulled down over his face.
Jeez.
He can't see his face. He's got this like a thing over his face, like a scarf.
Yeah.
And he has his bag with him. The bag is about 2 feet by 3 feet square.
Uh-huh.
A brown manila envelope, and it's really heavy. And he says, here. That's all he says, is here. We said, whoa, wait a minute. Who are you? What's to do? He just turned and I said, don't fall. So he gets in his car, and he takes off. And I look at Lewis. Lewis looks at me, and there's this huge bag. It weighs about 20-25 pounds.
Yeah.
Like that. Well, I said, well, let's go see what it is. So we find a Denny's that's open all night long. And we go in there, get a cup of coffee. And we sit down. We open this thing up. And inside this manila envelope are these aerial photographs. Aerial photos, hundreds of aerial photos of the entire Barstow to Vegas race course.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and they're from Caltrans. Now, I don't know if you know who Caltrans is. Caltrans,
yeah.
Caltrans are the people who maintain all those high-tension lines. They do all this.
Yeah.
California Department of Transportation. And they hate the BLM with a passion. The BLM, it makes life so miserable on these people
uh-huh.
that you can't believe it. They hate these guys. They hate each other so bad that you can't believe it. So here's this person. We assume that he was from Caltrans. He gave us all these aerial photos of the Barcelona Vegas race course. And we go, whoa, look at this. This is the starting line. This is going up the hill. This is that. Now, one of the biggest things that was in this complaint against us was this. There's a place called Coliseum Gorge. You go up to the Clark Mountains. It's right before the Nevada state line. You go up to the Clark Mountains, and you can descend the Clark Mountains.
Uh-huh.
And all the way down is a place called Coliseum Gorge. And Coliseum Gorge was what they called a threatened area.
Mm-hmm.
It was running water and air all year round. It was moss, all kind of rocks on the ground. And most guys would not ride down it going on a race course. They would get off their bike and walk their bike. Really, really tricky. You know, I mean, a couple of good pros like Jan Roberts or whatever, I'm sure, would ride their bike down. But, you know, most guys would walk their bike down right alongside their bike. And you'd get to the bottom of the thing about 300 or 400 yards. And then you're out in the desert and you go to the Nevada state line and you continue onward. And when we all sort of looked forward to Coliseum Gorge because it was sort of neat and running water and green moss on the rocks. And we went down that thing, you know, illegally, according to the BLM.
Yeah, right.
That was a conspiracy. Well, here's an aerial photo, and Coliseum Gorge isn't there anymore. Instead of Coliseum Gorge, there's a fire road. I went, what the hell is this?
Yeah.
And we look, and there's a post-it note on that photo. And we go to the back where the post-it note tells us, and there is a memo from the BLM to Jupiter Mining Claims. And Jupiter Mining Claims is a mining company on top of the Clark Mountains.
Uh-huh.
And they wanted to bring their trucks up there for easier access to the mining claim. And the BLM gave them permission to blade.
To put a road in, yeah.
Off the face of the earth.
Yeah.
And you could drive a Buick taxi cab up there.
Yeah.
Oh. So here they are. They're bitching at us.
Yeah, yeah.
For having ridden over this wonderfully sensitive area.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know? And the BLM gave Jupiter Mining Claim permission to lay the thing off. We go into court the next day, and we show this to the attorney, our attorney. And our attorney says, holy shit.
Yeah.
So the attorney goes, Your Honor, I request permission to a special audience. And he says, this is most unusual. So we all go back in the room together, me and Louie and the attorney and whatever. And he says, here you are, Your Honor. It's Coliseum Gorge. These people are accused of riding down Coliseum Gorge. And it doesn't exist anymore. And here is the BLM that gave him permission.
Mm-hmm.
And the BLM tried to have it thrown out of court because it wasn't introduced earlier as evidence and so forth. And the judge says, the judge, by the way, was a member of the Sierra Club.
Oh, yeah? Oh, geez.
I was really scared.
Yeah.
And we could have had him recused, but the judge says, don't do it, since you're liable to get a worse when this guy's least fair.
Yeah.
The judge got so mad, so utterly pissed, and he was furious.
Right.
He got so mad that he demanded that the BLM settle with us. And we had to go to a neutral ground and settle.
Wow.
The neutral ground, of course, was the FBI building in downtown L.A.
Yeah.
And that's where we settled. We got permission to ride the protest ride from then forth over the whole course.
Yeah.
And that's the story there.
Damn.
That's the kind of stuff we wanted to give the BLM or the AMA. We wanted to give them all the aerial photos and stuff, and they wouldn't take it.
So wouldn't do it. Wow.
No, because we were radicals.
Radicals, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You could so one could make a case that you guys have done more than the AMA has done in recent years. Yeah.
I can't tell you what I think of the AMA in a family audience. If I turned loose, I would use all my old Navy invectives up one fell swoop. I've never seen a bunch of dunderheads in my life. What they've done to this sport is they've absolutely ruined it.
Right.
Ruined it.
Well, super hunky. This has been great. Thank you for doing this. You got a new website.
Yeah, I've had a little website right along where I sell my books and
stuff. Yeah, I've read it. I've gone on it a few times. It's super interesting. Yeah.
Well, in about a week or 10 days, in fact, maybe this weekend, maybe next weekend, we're going to have this big website. A good friend of mine, Matt Cuddy, Matt just got paralyzed recently. He was on a street bike and got taken off the face of the earth by some crazy guy. He was on his Buell going to a courthouse to get some documents, and he's now in a wheelchair. And this is a guy who's been a dirt rider for his whole life.
Uh-huh.
And so, He's a good guy. He's a great writer. He's a really good writer. So we're going to put together this thing. It's superhunky.com. It's going to be free dirt bike classified ads for any and all. That's right. Anything to do with a dirt bike, parts, dirt bike, gear, trailer, truck, van, anything, hauler, anything to do, free dirt bike classifieds, all kinds of stories.
Oh, cool, yeah.
All kinds of neat stuff. So all they got to do is hit superhunky.com, and there it is, man. It's going to be a lot of fun. And I'll tell you, this Matt Cuddy is a good, good writer.
Yeah.
You guys, I'll tell you how good he is. He likes a Go Devil. You know what that is?
No.
I'll tell you, I'm going to make you look it up. He's on,
okay.
It was his first bike, a Go Devil.
I just wrote it down.
Lord. Good Lord.
And you're doing some writing for VMX magazine?
I do writing for VMX and Trail Rider.
Trail Rider, yeah.
And I've been writing for 12 years for offroad.com.
Okay.
But I think they're being sold now. I'm not sure what. But I did 12 years with those guys. And I sell books and sell posters and whatever.
Yeah, my brother ordered some posters from you a little while back. So
great.
He says
great.
Thank you for that. I believe you signed them yourself and everything. He was very excited about that.
Yeah, I can actually write.
Well, hey, thank you for doing this. Really, seriously, thank you for this. It's been a privilege for me to talk to you. Grew up reading your stuff, and I'm a passionate fan of the sport and everybody that covered it back then. And it's just really cool to have you on the show.
I'm just happy to have lived through those wonderful times. I don't think those times could ever happen again, but they did happen, and I consider myself a very, very lucky individual to have lived through that.
Yeah, and I would agree with that. All right, Rick, well, thank you very much for being on the BTOsports.com Transworld Motocross podcast show.
Thank you, buddy.
All right, see ya.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
This has been the BTOsports.com podcast show, brought to you by Transworld Motocross. Don't forget to check out some of our past shows, including motocross legends such as
The Beast from the East, Damon Bradshaw.
It got to the point to where I didn't want to leave home, and once I got to the race, I wasn't into it. If I wasn't going to give 100%, I'm not going to take their money.
The working class hero, Doug Henry.
It was definitely an emotional moment for me, just thinking to myself, that's it, you know, and it's amazing the stuff that goes through your head in a short amount of time of the things that, you know, that I was going to miss.
The Dogger, Ron Machine.
Until you really open your ears and you want to listen to what they're saying, it's like beating a dead horse. I mean, you know, and I know from personal experience, did anybody ever sit me down? Of course they did. Everybody did.
Pro Circuits, Mitch Payton.
There's two ways to make the money. One is you can sign for money, or two, you can earn the money. I'm a high believer in earning the money. I think they ride better when they earn the money.
Seven-time Jeremy McGrath.
I was so mad, like so disappointed and so frustrated that I pulled the pick and I left. Every point counts. I could kick myself to this day for not just riding around in tents. It's been no problem. My ego got in the way, you know?
The O Show, Johnny O'Mara.
Stuff that you sit there if you didn't even want to ride it, you just wanted to just look at it all day. I mean, I got a chance to test all that. I like that era I was in. I really do.
Search Mathis on the iTunes Store to find these and many more great podcasts. I won't let this die. You know I've got